The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
Go again. This song is by a singer-songwriter named Cheryl Wheeler, who has honestly made a whole lot of other really great music. Sadly, this is the one that most people know her for. It's called If It Were Up to Me. Came out in 1997, still as relevant today, unfortunately, if not more. Cheryl Wheeler, getting us started on this Tuesday. Why, you ask? Well, you may not know, because, and I'm saying this facetiously, only three people are dead so far. Six others have been injured at a school shooting in Oxford, Michigan, about an hour north of Detroit. The start of the shooting was 12:55 p.m. this afternoon. It took place in an area of the school where many history classes are. That gunshot at the end always gets me, but I think it's important to hear it. Let's see. At least one teacher was hurt. Police revealed that the shooter is in custody, so hey, we got that going for us. They were able to arrest him within 5 minutes of arriving on the scene. There were over 100 911 calls. And the shooter is 15 years old. He's already invoked his right not to speak. This is lovely. One shooting victim was shot in the face. That student's condition has not been confirmed. One mom talked about how troubled her daughter is. Quote, she's shaken. We were pretty much freaking out when we heard the news. You think? And here we go again. And I'm just, you know, before the show, I follow Randy Rhodes on the Progressive Voices Network, and I'm hearing the end of her program when she's talking about Lauren Boebert, that nut job from Colorado, who insists on bringing her Glock to work. Well, you're not allowed to do that. There are laws. This is just disgusting. This is not what I was going to be talking about today, but it's where we begin, because there's another fucking mass shooting at a high school in America, and the madness has got to stop, and yet we can't do anything about guns in this country. It seems we can't do anything about a lot of things in this country. And it's depressing as hell. But, you know, I used to play that song to open the show every time there was a mass shooting. And frankly, I got tired of the, I don't get a copyright violation when I do it, but I do get a content ID where it is a copyright ding, but it's not a strike. So it's not going to, you know, get me suspended from here. And I'm happy to give up whatever revenue I make from a day of streaming on YouTube in order to be able to play her song. But frankly, I don't want to hear it every day. I don't want to hear it every day because it's fucking depressing that in this, what used to be regarded as the greatest nation in the world, we have mass shooters on every goddamn corner. There's something really wrong there. There's a lot wrong, as you know, if you're listening to this program. So yesterday I was joined by David Daley talking about gerrymandering and how rat fucked we truly are. And we are. And, you know, I want to get a little further into this discussion. A week ago Monday, Mike Lux was on the program, and I had him on because he is a Democratic Party insider who is a progressive. And there's a reason I clarify that, because there are a lot of Democratic Party insiders who are far from progressive, and they're, you know, they're as big a problem to our progressive agenda as the Republicans are in this day and age. And that's sad. But, you know, there's a method to my madness here because I want you to know it's so easy to get discouraged. And we all do. And I know just by talking to many of you on the phone and reading the chat and answer and listen, reading your emails, that there are a lot of us progressives who are frustrated, who are disappointed, who have threatened to, that's it, I'm done, I'm never voting for a Democrat again. And I ask you, what is the alternative? Because in our system, the alternative is Republicans? Sorry, that's no alternative. We've been there. I remember before the orange guy got elected, and there were some people who said, well, maybe we just have to hit rock bottom. We'll see how bad it can get, and then we'll come back. Well, you see where that got us. Yeah, that got us to the place where we are today. And the place where we are today is not a good place. So let me tell you who is joining us today. And the reason I invited him on really has nothing to do with what I just said. It instead has to do with yesterday. Yesterday happened to be Palestine Day, or a day of solidarity with Palestinians. And a friendly acquaintance for many years is not only one of the brightest stars in progressive organizing in the country, but he also wrote a piece that I read yesterday that blew my mind because he grew up in Israel. I'm just going to bring him in and hold on because I got Laffy's name up there and that's not good. So our guest today is Charles. And Charles, you know what? I don't know how to pronounce your last name. Is it Lechner? Lechner? How do you say your last name?
You say Lechner.
Lechner.
I can tell you that there are many countries where people simply cannot pronounce it.
I was thinking about it last night, you know, because of that extra N between the E and the C, that is unusual. But Lechner, Charles, yes. Lechner. Charles has been an organizer. He has been an active activist for progressive causes for as long as I've known him. And we go back at least a dozen years or so. So, Charles, first of all, thank you so much for joining us today. As I said to you in the email, I've been wanting to have you on for just what I was talking about. I remember when I first, you know, I was a music disc jockey, a rock and roll disc jockey for many years. And when I got involved in political talk radio, it was right before George W. Bush came into office. And as I got involved in the movement in progressive politics, you know, you're one of the people that I look to. I also remember Tim Carpenter. Tim Carpenter, who used to run Progressive Democrats of America. And he and I had many conversations over the years. We lost him a long time ago, unfortunately. And what he used to always talk about was the inside-outside strategy. You got to do it both. Just being outside, as I would put you in that category, Charles, being outside protesting Occupy Wall Street and all these things that you've been involved in is so important. But if we don't have the inside component, the people like Mike Lux doing the work on the inside, then it's not going to come together. We need both halves of the whole. And so I had Mike Lux on last week to try to give a little bit of hope. To say, for all the people who were so upset when Joe Biden signed the so-called BIF into law before we had the bigger Build Back Better Act, the reconciliation bill, that was not part of the original deal, and people were apoplectic. They're like, "That's it, I'm so done because the Democrats just gave up all their leverage. I can't do this anymore." Well, the thing is, there is no alternative. Our job now is to strengthen the Democratic Party. And so that's why I wanted to have Mike on and I wanted to have you on. So, Charles, we're going to talk about this and your organizing and all the amazing work that you've done over the years, just in the years that I've known you, that you don't get a lot of recognition for. And I want to recognize you for it. But before we get to that, I want to start with the piece you wrote yesterday. And I was unaware of all of this. So yesterday was... what was yesterday? Tell us what the day was meant to be.
So yesterday was the UN inaugurated International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Okay.
It came out of that period of time in the 70s when the United Nations was often a battleground around colonialism and decolonization. This was a time where many nations, many countries were willing to say out loud that Palestinians needed a state of their own. And in the interim, before they get their own freedom and independence, the world should basically honor and recognize that and support that struggle in a way that is similar to the behavior of the international community around South Africa, which after many decades, finally, you know, there was enough pressure built up to kind of force the white supremacist regime to fold and negotiate an end to itself. Now, it's a fact that this day is not widely observed nowadays. Mm-mm. And in places where it is observed, it's often sort of like, oh, what's that? Sort of a man bites dog thing. There was an article the other day, an article about how in Philadelphia, there was a Palestinian community celebration yesterday with the mayor where he came. Huh. And they had you know, activists, not just Palestinians, they're waving Palestinian flags. And of course, the Israeli consul was like, "Y'all shouldn't do this." And the mayor was like, "We're going to do it anyway. Like, everyone gets a day. Everyone gets a day. This is their day. What do you want?" And it's a sign. It's a sign of the times that even something that might have been dormant and maybe not as impactful in the past, it stays around and then it gets picked up by a new generation. So I know that the reason why this day is marked is because November 29th is the day in 1947 when the United Nations General Assembly passed Resolution 181 stating that the mandate Palestine, then ruled by the British, must be separated into two different countries, one for Jews and one for Palestinian Arabs. And while we cannot discuss in great detail that full history, I just want to say for me, as someone who grew up in Israel and who had a change of heart at some point about the reality there, I think it's important to honor the fact that the Palestinians are a people, which was not something everyone gets to take for granted. And secondly, because they're a people, I think they should have the same rights as any other people.
Without a doubt. Now, you wrote a piece for a website, progressivehub.net, which you're involved with. That's through Roots Action, and you work for that organization with Norman Solomon and the other good people at Roots Action. So progressivehub.net, and the piece you wrote is called Reflections on This Year's Palestine Day by a Former Israeli Refusenik. And You know, I was going to read it, but you're here. So this piece, and you posted it to an email list that we're on, and I've not seen a piece get this kind of, you know, uniform reaction where people were just like, thank you for writing this. This is pretty amazing. So you relay the story. You grew up in it. Were you born in Israel? How did you wind up there? What happened?
No, when I was 6 years old, my mother, who was divorced at that time, basically emigrated there with me and my sister, wow, who was also young. And yes, that's a little odd. It felt odd at the time. It feels even stranger in retrospect. Uh-huh. But I ended up being raised in Israel, which meant that I learned Hebrew, attended Israeli grade school, and, you know, went through the system as one does. And the article basically sort of asked the question. The article wasn't about my refusing in the army. It was answering the question, how did you become a person who was willing to do that?
Right.
Which.
And you did. So you grew up at you actually enlist. You volunteered for the army. But everybody has to go in the army, right?
I don't want to get messy with the details, okay, but let's say it's not everybody, but it's most of the Israeli Jews. When they reach the age of 17 or 18, they're going to get called up.
Gotcha.
And I was one of them.
You were one of them. But you took a stand. You said, I will not go fight in the occupied territories.
Yeah, the specific formulation was basically that we gathered other young people who were facing conscription. We wrote a letter to the defense minister at the time that said, we care about our country. We care about democracy. We think that the occupation of Palestinians is a terrible thing for us. And when we are in the army, which we willingly go to, we are going to refuse orders if you ask us to help enforce the occupation of the Palestinian people, which is wrong and immoral and against our interests.
Uh-huh.
And while we were not the first group to ever do it, we just happened to be the group that did it right before the Intifada started.
Right. So, okay. So you were right there in the thick of it. So what were you punished for that?
There was prison time. But on balance, I'd have to say that the entire time I was in the army felt like a terrible punishment.
Uh-huh.
And prison was just like a little bit kind of more intense than the rest of the time. As you might imagine, this position did not endear me to my fellow soldiers.
I'll bet. Well, Charles, in this article, which I will link on the blog at NicoleSandler.com, where I post today's show with the date, it'll be 11-30-21. I also just put it in the YouTube chat room and the chat room at the NicoleSandler.com Listen Live page. And I hope people will read it. But you wrote, at the age of 16, I was one of a very small number of Israeli Jewish young people with Palestinian friends. That year, I visited the Jabalia refugee camp, am I pronouncing it right? In Gaza with a group of Palestinian citizens of Israel. It's hard to describe how aberrant that was or how angry my mom would have been had she known what I was up to that day. Tell us a little bit about that and your mom's reaction to the work you do now.
Well, I'll just say I was in 10th grade and it was a tumultuous year for me. I was very interested in the world. It's a time when young people were exposed to different organizations, youth movements, school activities. It's probably not that different than it is today, and also for American teens. I was attracted to groups that were doing stuff that were a little bit political and a little bit interesting, maybe divergent from most of my classmates. And I remember in early 10th grade, so the school was basically told, listen, you can send one or two kids from each class to this weekend seminar where they can meet Arab teens their own age, and go through some kind of a process of getting to know each other. And I remember sitting in the front of the classroom and I immediately raised my hand like, me, 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 like, I really wanted this. I looked back and no one else had their hand up.
Oh, my God.
So just to say, I was odd then as well as but they let me go. And it was the seminar was at a place called Neve Shalom Wahat Al Salam, which is a Jewish Arab community in Israel. Mm-hmm. Very rare thing. They have a school for peace. And they existed to facilitate this kind of event. And I went, and it was pretty cool.
And you talk about at one point you're around a campfire and you realize you're the only Jew around with a group of Arab teenagers. And you said this is the first time I'd ever been in that situation. Did it change you, though?
Well, just to be clear, I had previously had an encounter with Arabs my own age in Israel, because in ninth grade, my school did an exchange where we went to visit them in their village as a class, and then they came to visit us. It was very managed. Everyone had to do it. It was more formal. And I want to say it wasn't quite as meaningful. It wasn't great, but it happened. Mm-hmm. The distinction is that in this particular event, we had teens who chose to go there, who wanted to be there. We were going away from home for 2 days. It wasn't sort of with our families. So it was a more intense experience, and intense enough that on the Friday evening of that event, when the programming ended, the counselors basically said, all right, you guys can do whatever you want. One of those things that was on the table was hiking a little bit to the nearby monastery and buying some wine, which isn't as crazy in Israel at the time as it may seem today for someone who grew up in America.
Right.
And some people did that. There were a lot other kinds of activities. A lot of people just hung out in rooms. But I was invited to the bonfire in the center of this place. I showed up and I discovered that I was the only Jew who wanted to attend, because it was organized by some of the Arab kids. And it was definitely going to be an Arab language event generally. But I sat down and was like, all right, you invited, I'm here. Let's see what happens. And yes, I had never before been the only Jew in an Arab peer group in that way.
Right. So when did you wind up coming back to America?
That is a complicated answer, okay. But a way to simplify is that about 21, 22 years ago, I moved back to the United States for a job, and I've never gone back there to live.
Okay. Is your family still there?
Nope. The family did not stay.
Okay.
I will say Israel can be a tough country, regardless of anything political.
Gotcha. Look, I'm an American Jew. I am Jewish by heritage. I'm an atheist Jew. I don't practice any organized religion. I love the traditions. I grew up in a very secular Jewish family. So that's how I am. I still consider myself Jewish. But there's a real disconnect with Israel. I support the right of Israel to exist. I hate its current government. And I would liken it to the 4 years when Trump was in control. I hated our government. I had nothing positive to say about them. Didn't mean I didn't love my country or think it had the right to be here. Just the ruling entity was unacceptable. And that's sort of how I look at Israel in the last dozen or so years, maybe more. So it's a tough tightrope. Now, you are more entrenched in the progressive activist community, which has a very dim view of Israel these days, and for good reason. We see what's happened in Gaza. How do you walk that tightrope? How do you navigate the two worlds?
It's been difficult. We're lucky that within the Jewish community in the United States, there are pockets of progressives. There are pockets that may not be quite as progressive, but are still open. But the sad reality is that for the mainstream institutional community in this country, Israel became a core component of how we persuade children and teenagers and young adults to remain connected to the Jewish community, which is a way of saying that the community went through a process where religion and values and studying for your bar mitzvah as a core shifted to thinking about the Holocaust as a centering moment. And secondly, the establishment of the state of Israel as that second moment. So we went from almost being destroyed to rising up and being strong again. And that narrative was able to capture the hearts of many Jews, especially after the 67 and 73 wars in the Middle East. In the 1990s, a program started to birthright to bring American Jews over to Israel on a free 10-day trip.
Right.
And this process has only sort of entrenched itself even more, which is a way of saying that the Jewish community isn't in general sort of just concerned about Israel as a place where other Jews live. Israel became part of a marketing strategy for Jewish continuity. And that's made it painful for someone like me and very difficult to do something about, for anyone strategizing around that objective.
So what do you think about those birthright trips? Do you think it's a good thing? I've got a daughter who I've thought about sending there just so she could. I've never been to Israel. I would have liked to have gone. She's independent enough that I know she can make her own decisions, but I'm torn. I don't know if that's a good idea or not.
The only reason I'm torn is I'm not sure it works.
Oh.
If I thought it worked, I'd say don't do it.
Right. I hear you. Well, Charles Lechner, I'm going to, again, I hope people will read the piece. The way you ended it was very just human. And that's what's missing in this whole situation, the humanity. Where is the fucking humanity? I don't know. Are you familiar with an author named Yossi Klein Halevi?
Yes, I am.
Well, I stumbled upon his book, Letter to My Palestinian Neighbor, some months ago or last year at some point. And I wrote to him and he came on the show and we had a wonderful conversation. He's not as progressive as you and I. Years earlier, I had reached out to Uri Avnery. I'm sure you know Uri Avnery, who is
one of my heroes who I had worked with, and I'm sad that he's gone.
Me too, because I reached out to him some dozen years ago or so, and I had the opportunity to talk with him a few times, long distance. He's in Israel. He was a very old man, had a very thick accent, but I had the most amazing conversations with him. Me, this secular American Jew, and Uri Avnery, who founded the peace movement in Israel, Gush Shalom, who met with Yasser Arafat, who went against what everybody around him, believed was the right thing to do because he knew, because he was a human, because he saw the human condition there. And it was a horrible loss when we lost him. But I mentioned him to Yossi Klein, excuse me, Halevi, and he's like, I'm not in the same group as he is. But he did also, because he's more conservative, but he also saw the need to embrace our neighbors, these human neighbors of ours. So it's a complicated situation over there, I guess is the best thing we can say.
Well, it's very difficult. And I'll say one of the tragedies of the current moment is that the Palestinian National Movement, which has suffered defeat after defeat and saw the promise of the two-state solution yanked away from it after the Oslo Accords, some portion of it decided that any kind of normalization with Israel, with Israelis, is bad and counters their political objectives. And I'm not saying that's wrong and bad. I'm saying it's painful to see that that's where things have come. Because in my own life, the ability to have those engagements, to do things that would have been denounced as normalization today, but the freedom to do them when I was younger, are part of what made me who I am and brought me to the point of identifying myself as a Palestinian solidarity activist and really prioritizing that issue in my political life.
Now, in your piece, you said your mother, you didn't want her to know when you went into Gaza. How does she feel about your activities now? If she's still here.
I can't quite answer that. I'm not sure there'd be a coherent answer nowadays. But I'll say that at the time, she would tell me that she's very concerned that I was hanging around Arabs too much, who lie all the time and cannot be trusted.
Oh.
So when I would come back and say, I learned this, I learned that, she was very dismissive and always assumed that there was some other way of interpreting what I had seen or heard that made it not the way it was. But interestingly, during the Intifada, there was a famous incident when Israeli troops surrounded a Palestinian village. They grabbed some of the men and they buried them alive with a bulldozer.
Oh my God.
Buried them alive, causing, I forget if there were deaths involved. I think there were some, but more injuries. But it was an abominable act. And it was so callous. And obviously is not following protocol for an army. And when that happened, I said to my mother, do you still think that all those stories were lies? Do you still think that we're somehow not capable of doing these things? Because this was, you know, impossible to hide. And she had to admit, yeah, maybe there is some truth to all that stuff, for what it's worth.
Wow. If you don't mind, I want to read the last couple of paragraphs just because it's so beautifully written. You wrote, imagine looking at the moon without realizing you only ever see half of it. Then one day you learn it rotates in such a way as to keep the dark side hidden from human eyes for eternity. Such was the logic of Israeli education, at least for Jews. Suddenly I got to see the other side. This kind of experience was and is extremely rare. It motivated me to a lifetime of learning about my cousins, the Palestinians, my siblings in struggle, to see liberation as a shared project. After all, an occupying nation is never free. Not really. Do Palestinians have to be good people? Must they have good strategy? What silly conditions people have, especially defenders of Israel's rule over Palestinians. They are already all they need to be, a people. They already deserve what they need, your solidarity. And they know that someday they will be free. Most Israelis know this too, deep down inside. But they hide it so well, playing for time, spending our moral birthright down little by little, day after day. And that, my friends, is the criminal enterprise that will haunt us for centuries to come, if not millennia.
It's probably a sign of my inflated ego, but like I get teary-eyed listening to you read my own words.
Well,
it's an incredible source of pain. I want you and anyone hearing this to understand, I am very Jewish. I am not secular. I read Hebrew. I know how to pray. I am, while I'm not as learned as I'd like to be, you know, I can discuss things about the religion that are meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the legacy that we have carried for so many years has a lot more to do with ethics and morality and a way of being as a people that has nothing to do with subjugating another nation and nothing to do with the everyday cruelty and crimes and the systemic effort of an entire state to do this to another people. And even after we learn the truth to say, well, it happened and we're going to do it again.
Right.
Like, we're still going to keep it up. I just think of what we are burning off in this pursuit of power. It's not that I think peace carries no risk. It's not that I think there aren't arguments to be made about why Jews, a persecuted people, shouldn't be concerned for their safety and, you know, and so on. I get that. It's that I think there are some things so valuable, so holy, if you will, that we actually do have to risk them. We do have to risk ourselves for what we believe in. And if we don't, if we will not do that, it suggests that we've abandoned something that carried us for so many years. And I want that back. I want that to exist for my daughter and whatever future generations come forth. And I can't understand why giving that up makes so much sense to people who otherwise claim the mantle of religious authority.
Right. Well, we've seen the perversion of religions lately, especially here. You look at the 4 years under Trump and, you know, that the evangelical community embraced him. Again, I'm not a religious person, but if ever there was an antichrist figure, this is the man, right? He's their hero and they're bowing down to him. This scares the shit out of me.
Well, there's something I can add here as someone who was lucky enough to study Middle East history and Islamic history in college, which is that when we look at another culture doing something and they're using religious language and they're justifying it in the name of religion, it's important to understand that it's just an idiom in which regular politics operates. Israel may call itself a Jewish state, but it's really more of a state, simply a state, than a Jewish state. The Jewish part is an overlay of how you talk about it or how people feel about it. It doesn't change the fact that it's a state. It has a ruling class. It has corporations. It has a military-industrial complex. It has interests based on where it's located. It has resources it wants to protect. all those other factors get filtered through a lens of religious discourse. And the end result is that it corrupts the religious discourse. Mm-hmm. And on those grounds, I would say to anyone, you know, especially people who are very secular, like what you should wish for above all is that religion does not have power in the political and material world, not because it's not important, but because it's so important. It cannot be allowed to immerse itself fully in that.
Yeah, and yet one of the Neanderthals on the right, I get them all mixed up, maybe Paul Gosar, one of that ilk, suggested the other day that we need to have just one national religion.
I mean, I'm laughing because, I mean, if you were to come up with a religion that has a hard time not splitting into different factions, it'd be Protestant Christianity. I mean, have you ever go to Wikipedia and look a list of all the different sects and how easily they merge. It's like Southern Baptist, Northern Baptists, there's so many different varieties. Right? It just sounds like a terrible thing. And keep in mind, the reason why the Constitution says no established religion is not because they were trying to be friendly to Jews and Muslims. Right. Because they were terrified that the connection would actually fuel religious conflict.
Wow. No, and my husband just before, it was Michael Flynn who said that, of course, you know, just the most brilliant of them all. So, all right. So Charles Lechner, I keep stumbling over your name. Thank you for all of that. Thank you for writing that piece. Thank you for going there. Obviously, it's something I struggle with. And as a progressive, it hurts my soul when I hear others in our community, you know, say, screw Israel, screw the Jews. And I do hear it. And they've got to realize there's a difference between people who are Jewish and the state of Israel. They are not one and the same. Zionism is not Judaism. They're separate. And people need to understand that. And unfortunately, there is this threat of anti-Semitism that seems to be growing these days. It's just people don't understand the separation there.
It's very real, and it's good that you mentioned the Z word, Zionist. I'm sad to see how corrupted that the use of the word and the term has been almost universally. And I want to use this opportunity to say Zionism is a set of political ideas mm-hmm. about who should have power, how it should be exercised, and on what grounds. People can be a Zionist, you know, you could be a Zionist if you believe in those ideas. But a Zionist is not like a particular kind of human being.
Right.
And the reason why it matters is that every Jew living in Israel, every Jew who feels connected to Israel, who lives outside, like the United States, they might not be Zionist someday.
Right.
And if you really support peace and reconciliation and the transformation of the conflict into something better, you have to embrace the possibility of change rather than nailing the word Zionist onto everything to do with the conflict.
Yes.
Because by doing that, you're cementing your opposition. You're putting yourself in a corner. I would much rather talk to people who call themselves Zionists because they don't know any better. And then over time, we find out, oh, so you don't think that Jews moving to the Middle East will solve the Jewish question in Europe and around the world? Because that's what Herzl's Zionist thesis was, that the existence of a Jewish state would literally solve the issue for Jews outside the United States. That was a core tenet. There are other core tenets that even people who think they're Zionists no longer believe in. And the more we can tear that edifice down and make it clear that it's a temporal movement. It's a 19th century European nationalism. Europeans have gotten over a bunch of it. Not all of them.
No.
I think my people could get over a bunch of it. Maybe not all of it. But let's move in that direction.
Let's. And then you see what's going on today with Lauren Boebert and her just hatred, her horrible statements about Ilhan Omar. It's just reprehensible. And the fact that leadership, Republican leadership, doesn't see fit to call her out, to reprimand her for this. This is a scary sign of the times that we're living in, I believe.
I mean, what's crazy is that what we in the West refer to as fundamentalist Islam, political Islam, that current that gave rise to things like Al-Qaeda, it was a response to Western imperialist and colonial oppression in those societies. And in particular, things like how the U.S. armed and protected the Saudi Arabian monarchy, enabled its marriage to an extreme sect called Wahhabism,
right.
Supported its rise with cooperation in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. That thing that we want to say, it's them, they're crazy, they're extremists, they're evil. If you knew how many dollars flowed from the CIA into the pockets of that movement, not only in the past, but as recently as the civil war in Syria, you would just be like, wait, you mean we were literally arming Al-Qaeda types,
yeah,
like 4 years ago? Yes, we were.
Yes. And that's the work that you continue to do. So we're going to segue into that now. So, Charles, you know, I was trying to figure out how to identify you other than as like an amazing progressive activist. So, I, depending where I looked, I found different things. You're with Progressive Hub. You're the executive director of Organizing 2.0. You work with ACT.TV. You're the co-founder of People for Bernie. You're with Roots Action. You were original Occupy Wall Street activist. I know I'm leaving stuff out. If somebody asks you what you do for a living, what do you say?
I ask them if there's anything they really like or really oppose. Uh-huh. And whatever they say, I tell them I know how to help.
There you go. So you've been doing this. Again, we met as part of an email list a decade or so ago. We met at some Netroots Nation gatherings and things like that. And I've been impressed with you and the work you're doing. And so let's talk about Occupy Wall Street, because that was when the progressives really, I think, rose up and did something. And you were there at the beginning, yes?
I was there at the beginning. I want to, you know, with full honesty and humility, say that there were other people much more involved than me,
sure,
at earlier phases and throughout. But I was lucky. I was lucky to be, you know, embedded there for the time that I was. What I would say is that the in the United States, the left has been weak for generations, for decades. And in that weakness, people who wanted to have an impact from a strong left perspective, it wasn't clear that joining an organization would do the thing that you wish it would do, because the organizations themselves were weak. They had to contend with whether it was repression or just not being able to get things done. So this is a thriving ground for what I would call entrepreneurial activists. People get together and they say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if something happened that we could potentially do? Occupy Wall Street is an example. It emerged out of a group. In part, it emerged out of a group that was occupying the sidewalk outside of the mayor's office, Bloomberg, when he was mayor of New York.
Okay.
And they were protesting budget cuts and his, you know, terrible policies. And they were hopeful that by establishing a Bloombergville, this would lead in some inexorable way to him caving on issues that they cared about and fueling a movement. This did not happen. If I had been there, I might have said to them before they started, it probably won't happen. And they would have been very angry, and justifiably so. But by practicing these muscles of resistance, by building these communities of people who know each other and figure out who has what strength, who has what weakness, over time, you figure out how to get bigger and bigger things done. And the Occupy Wall Street moment was a moment where people who had been complete outsiders in one part of their life, but many of them were employees of unions, staff at unions or staff with political organizations like the Working Families Party. The dichotomy between inside and outside isn't only about two forces that can come together. Sometimes it's the same person who in the daytime has one job,
right,
and then in the evening hours goes and does something else. And I'll say that a hallmark of effective activism and organizing for me is recognizing that. And as a result, always looking for those bridges you can build with people who want to do something different. Those bridges are going to be super important when push comes to shove and you need to do something.
Right. No, and I agree. I mean, I think it is this inside-outside strategy that you've got to have both pieces in motion, and wherever there can be an intersection, so much the better. Just like, you know, having you on and having light, let there be light. And Mike Lux, I think it's important that we have both sides of the equation figured out. So you participate in Occupy Wall Street, you move on. And I say move on, and there's another organization. There's a lot of energy on the left. But here's where we differ from the right. We're all individuals and we all think for ourselves. And we don't take, you know, talking points on the radio or marching orders from some centralized authority figure. We meet in groups and we come up with a strategy and we do it. And sometimes it doesn't work. And sometimes we're working at odds with each other. Where are we now, the progressives? I know the Progressive Caucus in Congress has Pramila Jayapal as leader. And in that sense, they're great. But in another sense, where are we? Where are they?
I'm going to give an analysis that is very possibly wrong, but okay. I got it. And it goes like this. In those years where the progressives had little power, we developed an infrastructure of specialized entities. So an example would be a policy shop in D.C. And a good example of that might be Friends of the Earth, which does, you know, environmental climate work.
Sure.
We had businesses that specialized in canvassing, fundraising canvassing, political canvassing. The Working Families Party had one of those, as something that it created and gave it a lot of power. We had other organizations that focused on giving money away and then raising money.
Right.
All of these different entities basically followed a kind of a cooperation model where you stayed in your lane, you did the part that you were supposed to do and let someone else do their part. And the challenge was that the people that actually got the last mile done to pass a piece of legislation, those were the most compromised because they had to be in an environment where the reward structure was going to consistently reward you for giving in as opposed to standing up. And that created this massive disconnect between, labor unions, mainstream progressive groups, politicians in the Congressional Progressive Caucus. They had to live in that environment. They had to obey its standards in order to get anything done. And it's fair for them to say better to get something done than nothing. Like, that's reasonable. But you had a mass movement outside of that who were saying that's not enough. We want more. This objectively isn't enough. On climate, we can say your plans for saving the planet, they're just not scientifically valid. We're not saying we want more so you can negotiate with us. We're saying we should keep the temperature down. It's not the same conversation. And that mass movement was angry and frustrated and was constantly, you know, turning to that DC-oriented group and saying, you're sellouts. You're not doing what we want you to do. And my thesis is that we are transitioning to a different reality in which there are entire verticals that are doing all of it at the same time. They are managing the mass movement part of it and getting legislation written, staffing political offices, getting it passed, raising these demands. And that more integrated movement is just emerging. And for me, looking at the Bernie Sanders movement, looking at Congresswoman Jayapal, looking at all kinds of different struggles, I feel like that coming together as a movement is both exciting and powerful and full of conflict. Uh-huh. And my message would be, pay attention to those conflicts, not in order to defeat the people that aren't doing what you want. Look at the incentive structures. Look at the power that's on the table. Look at why people do what they do. In order for us to build that movement, we need to be much more willing to understand the other components in order to be integrated with them. Sadly, that instinct on both sides to be dismissive of each other, it's still there. We're still the same people.
We are. That, you know, there's such a, I mean, part of it, I think, goes to the big tent nature of the Democratic Party. And it is indeed that. And some might say it's, you know, maybe too big. I don't think that's possible. Although in the sense that right now, because the Republican Party is so split, because you have so many people who the Never Trumpers who have nowhere else to go. So all of a sudden they're coming over to the Democratic Party trying to pull us further to the right. I want them to split off from the Republican Party and form their own party. Let them bicker about it. Let them split in half. But leave us alone unless you really believe the things we're fighting for. And unfortunately, you know, that's why I rarely watch MSNBC these days, because it's this Never Trumper mentality. And yes, we're Never Trumpers, but we're Democrats. And my listeners, at least, are progressives. So you know, I had a show yesterday. I spoke to David Daley, who was the author of the book Ratfuck, talking about gerrymandering. And what we're looking at right now is truly frightening. And I think that the number one priority, yes, I want them to get the Build Back Better bill going, and I want the infrastructure, and I want the jobs and everything that goes along with it. But I think if they don't fix our voting issues and pass the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Advancement Act, then we're screwed. Why even bother having an election? And there just doesn't seem to be that urgency on the part of the administration. And I've got a lot of listeners and people I talk to every day who are really, really frustrated. So what do we do?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I have the proper background to give really great answers here, but I'll say this. On the issues that we Democrats care about, things like health care or not invading other countries or taxing the rich more, we have solid majorities of this country behind us.
Right.
Most Democrats, a bunch of independents, and even some Republicans will back these policy ideas. But when it comes to wanting to hang out with us and listen to us tell them how they're wrong, there's a big part of the country that doesn't want to work with us on that level.
That's true.
And the conclusion for me is maybe we should figure out a way to emphasize the things where there's agreement on a policy outcome rather than follow the right-wing troublemakers into the culture war traps that they set for us. And it's a hard thing to say out loud, because when I say the phrase, you know, the culture war traps they set for us, what's actually happening is that they're doing a backlash against the recognition and rights and representation of historically marginalized communities in the United States. Like that's what's happening, right? So navigating the tension between these things is incredibly difficult. But I still think that if we know that a particular policy outcome has a solid majority, we should politically kind of stay closer to that in order to achieve it, rather than say, oh, you'd like to talk about how, you know, I don't want to name an issue for fear of getting canceled, but like they're constantly drawing us into their strong territory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mistake to follow them there.
I agree. We do enough of our own. It's the old Democratic Party circular firing squad, or it's the, you know, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. And then there's this little cartoon that somebody tweeted yesterday that caught my attention. I'm going to put it up on the screen. But there's Joe Biden approval rating, 36%. And someone says he'll be even livelier in 2024. Then Kamala Harris approval rating, 28%. And there's a little arrow. It says in case Joe dies, might be salvageable with a total personality change or a muted mic. And then there's Pete Buttigieg, approval rating 37%. Plan C, if Kamala doesn't catch fire, brings in the crucial twerp vote. And then in the last frame, it says Bernie Sanders approval rating 60%. And the cartoon heads there say, thank God we stopped him. We really dodged a bullet there. That, of course, was Ted Rall. The things that make you go, are often also the really true things. And that just is like, I think I retweeted it with the saying, reality bites.
Right. But I want to introduce something else to kind of teeny bit complicate.
Okay.
So I think most people who've taken the time know that when we invented the printing press as humans, we started a multi-century process of mad warfare over religion. Why? Because finally, we could arm all the troops with enough copies of the Bible to really want to kill each other.
Oy.
And the connection between communication technology and conflict is just very strong. Now we're in a moment where we're understanding how groups like Facebook, Twitter, social media enterprises are essentially doing something with their technology. In the past, in order to have a successful drug cartel, you had to kind of produce the stuff, you had to get it across borders, you had to hide from the cops. It's a very, very fraught process. You know, we don't like that. But imagine if you could sell me a drug with my handheld phone.
Uh-huh.
That's what's happening. They figured out how to sell us dopamine from our own brains by using social media as a key to unlock it. And the process of becoming addicted to that is also the process of increasing the amount of social conflict in a society. I don't have an answer to this, but I think it needs to be paid attention to. There's a reason why these tactics of Boebert work. There's a reason why conversations about the culture war are so impactful. It's because as much as we want to think that we're rational people who want things that we need, food, healthcare, you know, whatever, there's something that we need usually even more than any of that. And that's the feeling of, I'm okay to be in this world. I'm respected. I have a place. I have standing in the community. I matter. And in some ways, the right wing tells its base yes to all of that, no matter what anyone else says. And the progressives have a habit of saying, maybe if you do what we say and speak the way we speak. And in that contest, the standard setting left is going to lose. Because the human need to simply be seen as legitimately okay to be what they are is going to predominate over, call it the, you know, the deficit model of, well, no, you can't because you haven't done the work. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's been in a relationship knows that telling your partner that they haven't done the work and they have to go do it is not usually a sign of a healthy relationship.
Right. That's true. That's true. So
true as it may be.
So in the minute or two we have left, Charles, for all the people who are listening, who are frustrated progressives, who are ready to give up, but know that they can't because there's no alternative, what do you suggest? What organizations should they join? Where should they get involved? What should they be doing?
Honestly, my full humility, I don't think it matters as much which one as it does that the muscle of being part of an organization that makes decisions democratically, that meets in person, that where even if things didn't go your way, you do it anyway, and there's good feeling and camaraderie. We Americans have lost so much of our ability to behave that way. I'm sorry, not all Americans. I mean the ones that don't go to a good church.
Okay.
Because they got that. They got that.
They do.
They got that.
They do, yeah.
But if that's not you, no. You may need some of this, and you may not have it, and you better find it. Because we're going to need it.
Without a doubt. Charles Lenchner. Lenchner? Thank you so much. This has been a great discussion. It's been long overdue. I thank you for the work you do. And I thank you so much for joining us today and going through this with us. I think it was a cathartic experience. I think it was necessary. My pleasure. It's great seeing you again. It's been a while. Thanks so much, Charles. I'll let you go, and we'll talk online. Take care. You can find him, C. Lenchner, on Twitter. I'll put links to everything on the blog at NicoleSandler.com/11-30-21. That's where the show will be posted, both the audio podcast and the video, too. So you can take it however you want it. And with that, we're basically at the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed that. It was a deep philosophical discussion, really prompted by, again, the piece that he wrote that's up at progressivehub.net, and I will post that on the blog as well. Sometimes you got to think about these things, and certainly I do right now because of the dilemma we find ourselves in. And I wanted to let you know, just as I wanted to let you know, like Mike Lux and people like him exists, real progressives who are on doing the inside work. And there are a lot of people like Charles Lenchner out there doing the outside work. And occasionally the two cross paths and work together. And that's the only way we're going to beat this influx of fascism, of crazy, of right-wing radical fucking nuts, insurrectionists who try to overthrow the government and overturn a free and fair election. When you put it in those terms, it's like, okay, so who's fighting back? When we look at the gerrymandered maps and we think, who is going to save democracy for us? Well, it's got to be all of us. And that's why I wanted you to meet Charles, because he's one of many. And there are a lot of us, and there's strength in numbers. And I fully believe there are more of us than there are of them. And, we go through cycles. And unfortunately, right now, we're in a really, really ugly one. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court is going to hear a challenge to Roe v. Wade. A real challenge. And the court is made up of, three people who Trump stole Supreme Court seats for, specifically so they could overturn Roe v. Wade. Trump, who doesn't believe in any of it,
But he, the money was coming into him. And people think of him as a, you know, brought by God. We're living in the age of delusion. We need to step up and do our part. So anyway, sorry it was so heavy and long-winded today. Tomorrow, we're also going to get kind of spiritual. Kelly Carlin is going to be here and maybe help us get a little bit out of our heads and figure out a way forward. Because there are some people who I've spoken to who are literally scared out of their minds, depressed, and really anxious about the direction that this nation is going. I don't know if Kelly can help us through that, but she sure can try. So we'll do that tomorrow. Thank you for listening, everyone. Really appreciate you being here. And with that, we're done. I will leave you with the news. Again, I hope that wasn't too heavy for you. I think it was an important discussion to have. We're not alone. And we have not lost anything. Well, we have lost some things, but it's not over. It's not over. We still have a democracy to fight for. All right. I'll leave you with the news. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Welcome to the end of the year legislative traffic jam. Already, some members are making plans to stay in D.C. through the holidays because of the huge to-do list, starting with the National Defense Authorization Act. Chuck Schumer had planned to move on this one by the middle of the week, but Mitch McConnell had other plans. On Monday night, the minority leader rallied his caucus against shutting down debate and voting, saying they want more time for amendments. Schumer believes it's an intentional effort to create that year-end pileup and thwart passage of the Build Back Better Act. Then there's the issue of government funding, with a deadline of this Friday. It appeared that a stopgap funding bill to keep the government running through late January was ready to go until Republican Senator Richard Shelby hesitated on the timeline. He wants to stretch it out into the spring. And of course, there's the fight over the debt ceiling. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that we'll hit it right around December 15th. Republicans want Democrats to do it by themselves via a reconciliation bill, which would require zero Republican votes. That's something Chuck Schumer is set against. Fun times indeed. Meanwhile, Janet Yellen and Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell testified today, Tuesday, before the Senate Banking Committee. From Yellen's prepared testimony, this regarding the debt ceiling. She said, quote, "I cannot overstate how critical it is that Congress address this issue. America must pay its bills on time and in full. If we do not, we will eviscerate our current recovery. In a matter of days, the majority of Americans would suffer financial pain as critical payments like Social Security checks and military paychecks would not reach their bank accounts. And that would likely be followed by a deep recession." Yeah, we don't want that. Meanwhile, stocks and oil prices fell Monday as more cases of the Omicron coronavirus variant were reported globally. At least 19 countries have reported cases of the variant, and 70 countries and territories have now imposed travel restrictions. Discouraging words from the CEO of Moderna, who said that the current vaccines may not be very effective with this variant. But Pfizer's CEO said that boosters, even if they're not as effective as they were against Delta, should reduce the threat of Omicron dramatically. Either way, the CDC says Omicron is all the more reason for all vaccinated adults to get a booster shot because, they say, strong immunity will likely prevent serious illness. President Biden spoke to the American people Monday afternoon about the virus and the new variant.
"Today, there are three messages about the new variant that I want the American people to hear. First, this variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. We have the best vaccine in the world, the best medicines, the best scientists, and we're learning more every single day. And we'll fight this variant with scientific and knowledgeable actions and speed, not chaos and confusion. We have more tools today to fight the variant than we've ever had before, from vaccines to boosters to vaccines for children, 5 years and older, and much more. A year ago, America was floundering against the first variant of COVID. We beat that variant significantly, And then we got hit by a far more powerful threat, the Delta variant. But we took action, and now we're seeing deaths from Delta come down. We'll fight and beat this new variant as well. We're learning more about this new variant every single day. And as we learn more, we're going to share that information with the American people candidly and promptly. Second, the best protection against this new variant or any of the variants out there is getting fully vaccinated and getting a booster shot. If you're 18 years or over and got fully vaccinated before June the 1st, go get the booster shot today. They're free and they're available at 80,000 locations coast to coast.
Three judges from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals will hear arguments today in the former guy's lawsuit. He's trying to prevent the release of White House records, including call logs, speech drafts, diaries, email calendars, schedules, memos, and a whole bunch more from the January 6th committee investigating the uprising. Ghislaine Maxwell's trial is in full swing. She, of course, the wing woman, I suppose, for Jeffrey Epstein. And remember Jussie Smollett, the actor who falsely claimed he was the victim of a hate crime attack? Well, the case against him for falsely reporting a hate crime got underway Monday, too. Twitter's Jack Dorsey, the co-founder and public face of one of the biggest social media platforms in the world, has stepped down as CEO. His resignation was effective immediately. He said he thinks the company is, quote, ready to move on from its founders. Okay, so today is November 30th. The official end of hurricane season, something we celebrate every year down here in South Florida. There were 21 named storms with seven hurricanes, four major hurricanes, Grace, Ida, Larry, and Sam. Ida, the only one making landfall, but four of those named storms still left over $1 billion in damage each. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. We survived Black Friday and Cyber Monday, and now it's Giving Tuesday. A great day to remember and support the people who bring you news and information with a progressive point of view. Donations to the Nicole Sandler Show and the Progressive Voices Network go a long way in keeping us going. Visit NicoleSandler.com and ProgressiveVoices.com and help us out if you can.